Hello and welcome to the Martin Driving Podcast number 61. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around I am embracing the silliness. I'm looking at two quite silly, for different reasons, science fiction movies. The first is from 1953 and is called Project Moonbase. And the second one is a cult classic and a lot of fun, and that is 1998's Killer Clowns from Outer Space. So we're going to be going from a script by Robert Heinlein to a script by the Chiodo brothers. So sit back, I'll get the contact details out of the way, and the silliness will start. The Martian Drive-In Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of science fiction, horror and fantasy movie appreciation. It doesn't matter what it is, it could be all the way from George Méliès through to Michael Bay, though I'm not likely to do Michael Bay. But feedback is important to me. So if you want to leave some feedback, you can leave it at cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, at gmail.com. You can leave it at the Martian Drive-In Podcast website, marsdrivein.blogspot.com. The other thing you can do is go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. So if you type in Paleo-Cinema Cafe into Facebook, you can go and leave some feedback there as well. Now, there are occasionally adult concepts in this podcast, so just keep that in mind as you listen, and sit back and enjoy the rest of the show. Hi, how is everybody? We are fine here. I have pork ribs cooking in the oven, so all is right with the world. And the weather is pretty shitty, to be honest with you. It's cold and damp and nothing like I like. But having said that, 2 weekends from now, I'm at Continuum 11, the science fiction convention for Melbourne, and I'll be doing the live recording of Martian Driving Podcast there. I've got to get actually another episode in before that, because there's an episode due to be released that weekend, and I simply won't have time to edit down the recording in time to release it as that podcast, if that makes any sense to anybody. But looking forward to it. I'm getting Grant Watson and Sonia Mark on again to be my guests, and hopefully we'll get a little bit of audience participation and have some groovy fun with that. And, of course, the week after that, Sal and I are going to Perth for 10 days, which is going to be quite nice. And haven't been there for a long time. I haven't been there for maybe 15 years, but I'm looking forward to. And as I said in the last Paleo Cinema Podcast, one of the things we're doing there is we're going to a 40th anniversary screening at the backlot of Jaws, which is going to be a lot of fun. Looking forward to that, amongst other things, and to just having some chill out. This, of course, means that I've got to get a few episodes under my belt before then, so I can release them on the normal schedule, because that's what I do. There may be music episodes. I'm not sure yet. I may have time to do actual movie episodes, but I might do a couple of music episodes just to give myself some breathing space. But I'll let you know whether I do or not. One way or the other, things will continue, and your fortnightly dose of Martian Driving Podcast and Paleo Cinema Podcast alternating will continue. I make that obligation. So I've been watching a few things, and as usual, I'll crank up my Letterboxd and take a look at them. Let me see. I watched an old favourite of mine, which was released by Olive Films as a Blu-ray, and I picked that up about a year ago. And that's a nice little spy flick, which has got a great cast, called Innocent Bystanders. It stars Stanley Baker as an ageing secret agent, a kind of ageing James Bondian character. It's got Donald Pleasence playing his spy master. You got Vladek Chabal in it, because Vladek Chabal was in every spy movie made between about 1960 and 1980. And Geraldine Chapman. So it's got a really nice cast in it. And I kind of like it as well. Warren Mitchell's in there as well, playing a Turk, which is an interesting choice. But there you go. And I watch it every few years, because it's one of my kind of, you know, vulgar pleasures as far as spy movies are concerned. I did see a low-budget 1960s American independent film called The Miniskirt Mob, about a whole bunch of kind of not really bikers, but sort of bikers, who hassle a couple because the guy has deserted one of the women in the bike mob, played by Diane McBain, who pretty much runs it. And they hassle her. It's got a whole bunch of kind of B and C character actors in it, with one exception. It stars Paddy McCormack's in it, the kid from The Bad Seed, as an adult playing one of the bikers. As I said, it's got Diane McBain in it, Jeremy Slade's in it, Sherry Jackson's in it, and also Harry Dean Stanton, which made it more interesting than it would have otherwise been. So I watched that, and while I'm on the low-budget kind of bad stuff, I watched a Joe Don Baker film called Mitchell, where he plays a kind of slightly rogue cop out investigating usual kind of mafia-type dudes and all that kind of thing. It also stars Linda Evans as a hooker. And, yeah, it's not really very good, but I watched it anyway. Now, for the radio gig, Rebecca McLaren and I did Monsieur Hulot's Holiday, which I've talked about before on podcasts, starring Jacques Tati. It's a nice, gentle comedy, very accessible for people who aren't familiar with French films, because most of the comedy, the humour, is non-word-based. Some of it's audio, but it's very much non-word-based stuff, and it was good to play around with that. I did see a little kind of horror film, a fairly lowish budget horror film, starring David Koechner and Ethan Embry, called Cheap Thrills, which is very nasty. It's kind of gory in spots, but there's a kind of ickiness to it, which is pretty extreme. It was recommended to me, actually, by somebody saying, yeah, this is definitely your kind of film. And yeah, it's a good film. It's well made, and it does have a lot to say about the current state of America in some dark and horrible ways, and also, by association, Australia. And then I went with one of fun, silly movies, because I'm in a fun, silly movie mood at the moment, and that's with a kind of comedy about gay and transvestite motorcycle riders called The Pink Angels from the early 1970s. Stars John Alderton and nobody else you've ever really heard of, even if you've heard of John Alderton. But, yeah, it's got some nice lines in it, and it's a bit silly, and it's very different from anything else you're going to see out there. And, yeah, the ending was a bit weird. But I watched The Pink Angels, and then I watched something else, which I'm going to save an entire podcast for. And I'll probably rope in one or two people to do it with me, because I want to do this movie full justice. And that is Mad Max Fury Road. I saw it in 2D at the cinema, and that one is a game changer. It really is. It kind of winds back all the things that are wrong with big budget action films lately and takes them in a different direction. Now, I know it was filmed in Namibia, and I said, oh, it's got an Englishman starring in it, an Englishman and a South African, but it really is a game changer. And I'm not going to talk more about it now, but I'm going to save that for an entire podcast. I really want to do that. Now, I haven't forgotten the podcast movies that I owe people for the Patreon campaign, so please, Patreon supporters, please don't think that I'm kind of fobbing you off. The agreement is I'll do it within a year, and I'll definitely do it within a year, but Mad Max Fury Road, I think, deserves some attention, and I'm going to give it some before I go and get the list, which is in a big book sitting up on the top of the shelf above my desk. I was just looking at it then, if my voice changed at all. And I will go through those and do it. I've got the movies. I've got all the movies together that I've been asked to do for the podcast, and I will indeed review them for either Paleo Cinema or Martian Driving Podcast, whichever is the most appropriate. So, I'm going to take another break, and this is the first break of the podcast. What the fuck am I talking about? But I'm going to take a break, and when I get back, we're going to look at Project Moonbase, an incredibly silly, low-budget 1953 American science fiction movie with a script written by the godfather, and I mean that totally in a mafia sense, of science fiction, Robert Heinlein.
Orders from the minister himself that we must not fail in destroying this perpetually menacing eye in the sky.
But now that we have a satellite station in space revolving around the Earth, a satellite view, I might add, directly to the heroic first orbital flight by Colonel Brighthouse, danger, adventure, and breathtaking thrills come rocketing to the screen as science smashes a new frontier in the world of tomorrow. See a man-carrying rocket travel 240,000 miles to land on a spaceship. See man explore the desolated areas of the moon. See, for the first time, thrilling pictures of the world of tomorrow.
The Joint Chiefs have conferred with the President and it's been decided to change your mission. You are now Moon Base Number One. You will remain where you are and show the flag until such time as you can be relieved by a larger permanent force.
That's the trailer for the 1953 American science fiction movie Project Moonbase. The movie was directed by a German-American actor, stuntman, director called Richard Talmadge, whose real name was Sylvester Metz. And it stars some people who you probably never heard of, really. Donna Martell, Ross Ford, and the only person you will have heard of, possibly, is Hayden Rourke, who plays the General Green. Hayden Rourke is a guy that played Dr. Bellows in I Dream of Jeannie, so we know him from that and from endless reruns of that. Now, the script for the movie was written by Robert Heinlein and a guy called Jack Seaman, which you can giggle at later. He didn't do too much writing. He mostly did a few westerns. He produced a few westerns, and the only thing he did a writing credit on was Project Moonbase, oddly enough. The story is really simple. It's set in the future year of 1970, and a saboteur posing as a scientist strives to destroy the world's first space station, according to IMDb. And that's pretty much it, though there is a little bit to say and some weird things that make this silly. And remember, this is the silly episode of the podcast. Donna Martell, who plays Colonel Brighteyes, B-R-I-T-E-I-S, is kind of cute and perky and not the sort of person you'd really think would be the first person to orbit the Earth in a rocket ship. Ross Ford plays the other person on the moon mission, Major Bill Moore. He's very much a generic sort of actor, neither better nor worse than he has to be for this kind of a project. It was a very low-budget film, and it was very quickly put together. And originally it was going to be the pilot episode of a TV series, which is a little bit unusual for the time. It was going to be a TV series called World Beyond, which is a very 1950s sort of name for a TV series, particularly a science fiction one. But the reason they didn't do it that way was in 1951, 2 years before this movie came out, Destination Moon came out, and that had a script by Robert Heinlein. It was very successful. It did have a few advantages over this one. It was longer. It had George Pal involved in it, along with Byron Haskin. It was filmed in colour, and this one's in black and white. And it was made with a lot more money involved. And the plot made sense. Project Moonbase, on the other hand, starts out with a little bit of a crawl across the screen to set up the world in which it occurs. And that crawl says, in 1948, the Secretary of Defense proposed that the United States build a space station as a military guardian in the sky. By 1954, atom bombs and intercontinental missiles made it a necessity. In 1966, the first orbital flight was made by Colonel Brighteyes. By 1970, the space station had been built and free men were reaching for the moon to consolidate the safety of the free world. But while this was going on, the enemies of freedom were not idle. They were working to destroy the space station. So that's the crawl at the start of it. And the first thing that's going to leap out at you with that is, apart from the fact that it's kind of a bit boring, the fact that free men are up in the space station consolidating the safety of the free world. So the next mission, 4 years after the first orbit, is to travel around the moon, suss out where the best places to land are for a future mission, which was what was actually done with some of the early Apollo programs. So that the scientific stuff in this movie isn't that bad. It really isn't. But the problem is you've got Colonel Brighteyes, who's basically the Yuri Gagarin of the alternate world this movie is set in, being treated like she's 10 years old and acting like she's 10 years old. Donna Martell acts like a naughty schoolgirl through most of this movie, which is kind of endearing at some level, but just not right. And though, to be even-handed on it, the guy's not much better. The Major Bill Moore, played by Ross Ford, isn't much better. He's pissed off 4 years later because he got gazumped on the first orbital mission by Colonel Bright Eyes. Oh, yeah, and I should mention, too, that all the men in the movie pronounce Bright Eyes like it's B-R-I-G-H-T-E-Y-E-S. So kind of like the Art Garfunkel song in Watership Down. And Bright Eyes herself, being no better, doesn't want to go on this mission with Bill because he doesn't like her. Now, the level of professionalism shown here is fantastic. At the start of the film, though, we've got some scenes with the commies who are basically organizing to replace Dr. Werner, the scientist who's going on the Around the Moon mission with them, with one of their guys who looks exactly like Dr. Werner except for the fact that he dyes his hair. So they get his guy's hair grey and they send him off and they kidnap Dr. Werner, and all this takes place in a couple of hotel room sets that happen to be left over from some TV show or other. And the cool thing about this is they're all dressed in late 1940s suits. So this is 1970. Nobody's even tried to do much futuristic apart from one thing. What they've done is they've got cordless phones by getting an old-fashioned Bakelite phone and sticking the heating element out of an electric jug onto the end of it like an antenna to make it look like the cordless phones. Okay, we'll give them that. We'll give them the fact that they at least made a token effort to say that it wasn't 1953, but it was actually 1970. So that's the only thing that they've done. And the weird thing about it, too, is that these communists are a lot better organized than the American military. The American military don't do even a fingerprint check on Dr. Werner to make sure he's the right guy. He just shows them a document and they let him aboard a spaceship. It doesn't really work like that. In real life, with any kind of security measure, there's usually something more than just, here's my documentation with a picture of me on it. Even in those days, security was just that little bit tighter than is shown in this movie. But the whole idea is to get an enemy aboard the spaceship, which is going to go around the moon and lead America to keep their sovereignty over space. So the rocket launches, and the special effects for the rocket are a bit ropey, but they're kind of cute in a naive kids' home movie kind of way. And then the general, who has to explain things like orbital dynamics and docking and undocking and what the space station looks like and how rockets work and all that kind of stuff to somebody. So we get a female journalist called Polly Prattles, who's played by an actress called Barbara Morrison, who's very matronly and is dressed up kind of like she's a matron at a masquerade ball pretending to be the Queen of Mars. And she comes along and basically she's treated with enormous disrespect in a number of ways, the first one of which is that as a female journalist, she's supposed to act dithery. She doesn't have the professionalism of a male journalist. Now, it's like these people had never seen His Girl Friday or something like that, because she's just basically, it's like they got a gossip columnist to cover the biggest scientific news story in the world. It's that kind of level of idiocy there. So Polly Prattles talks to the general about how much, you know, about going to the moon, how wouldn't it be lovely to be weightless, because she's a lady who's got a bit of weight on her. And then the general says, no, you couldn't do that because it costs us $10,000 for every pound that goes up into space. Basically fat-shaming a journalist he's giving a story to. Not the coolest thing that could have been done, and not the kindest thing that could have been done. But it was done. Women are treated really shitty in this movie, I tell you. They are shamed by the men in the movie. First, the general with Polly Prattles, you know, basically fat-shaming her backhandedly. Then we've got Bill's shitty attitude because Bright Eyes happened to get the historic seat on the first orbital mission, and he's still got the shits about it 4 years later, which shows a singular lack of maturity from my point of view. And right at the end of the movie, too, I'm going to jump to the end just so I can demonstrate a point here. Right at the end of the movie, the President of the United States is shown, and she's an older lady. She's like Hillary Clinton plus age, and talks like Eleanor Roosevelt. So in spite of the fact that the President of the United States is a woman, the first person to go into orbit is a woman. And the journalists they picked to cover the story of the first flight around the moon is a woman. Women get treated really shitty. And at one stage, when Brightice is talking to the general before the takeoff as well, we get more of that Heinlein patronizing shit, where because she disagrees and questions her orders, the general threatens to spank her, because that happens all the time in the real military. Women are threatened to be spanked by allegedly superior officers, and that kind of sucks too. This is one of those movies that I know at least four or five women who I've sat down to watch this movie with them will be infuriated by the time the 63 minutes has elapsed. It's just that bad. Now, I've got to remember, I'm thinking 1950s. There were examples of strong women in cinema up till this time. There were a number of them. There was, going back to, say, His Girl Friday, Rosalind Russell's character in that, Hildy Johnson, strong female character. You've got everything that Katharine Hepburn did up to that time, including the African Queen. So it's not like the strong women were totally unknown in cinema. But in this one, they decide that they can't do that, and that they've got to have the women be basically either one of three things: old women who run a country, ditzy journalists, or little poppets who just happen to get lucky, and it's not because of any skill, but they just happen to get lucky enough to be Yuri Gagarin. So that's what Heinlein sets up in this movie and in the script. And it's no wonder the bloody thing never got made into a TV series. But then we get into the mission as well, and they do the dumbest thing ever. They do the thing that William Holden did to Peter Graves in Otto Preminger's Starlink 17, which is basically outing a foreign spy because he doesn't know about baseball and doesn't know who the Brooklyn Dodgers are, even though I live across the other side of the planet and I know who the Brooklyn Dodgers are. But leaving that aside, that's how the Colonel Major Bill figures out that Dr. Werner isn't Dr. Werner. And I just checked my notes on when I was watching the movie too, and the reason Colonel Brighteyes was the first person to orbit the Earth wasn't because she was competent, wasn't because she was a good pilot, wasn't any of that shit. It was because she was small and there was a bigger safety margin having a smaller person on the flight. That's the excuse given by the movie, which really is really, really annoying, I suppose. But and the other thing, too, is because of that weight limitation thing, even though they've got tons of spare shit on the spaceship that they don't really need, the weight is of a premium, apparently. The uniform for people aboard spaceships is T-shirt and shorts and funny little skull caps. Oh, shit you not. Funny little skull caps, T-shirt and shorts, which kind of works nicely when you're looking at Donna Martel, but it does look less good on Dr. Werner, who's a middle-aged gentleman. One of the other silly things in this movie that works kind of well but really weirdly is that the pressures of taking off from launching a spaceship from Earth are such that the people on board the spaceship scream their lungs out because they've got the kind of light couches that people are laying on the spaceship, the three crew are laying on, and all of them scream from the G-forces. Now, we all know that that probably wouldn't happen because the G-forces on your chest would squeeze all of the air out of your lungs anyway. But they're all screaming like somebody is doing bastinado on them while they're launching. And that kind of is disconcerting because, keep it in, I mean, Robert Mitchum was tough. He didn't scream in movies. He just sucked it up and yeah, you could see him sweat on his forehead and his lip would tremble and that would be it. But no, these guys are screaming like babies. And I lost all respect for all of the characters at that point. Not that I hadn't already lost it. Anyway, the fake Professor Werner or Dr. Werner or whatever he is, his mission is to blow up the space station, but he kind of, you know, doesn't get around to it while he's on the space station. So he thinks about this while he's on the rocket about to go around the moon and then decides he's going to crash that. So he goes berserk and people start wrestling on the floor in high gravity, the two guys do, while Donna Martel's Colonel Brighteyes looks on and kind of screams a little bit. The spaceship lurches out of control, and the only way they can save things is to land on the moon. They land on the far side of the moon very slightly, and so two of the people have to go out and set up a relay antenna up on a little ridge line in order to get a signal to Earth and say, yes, we've landed. We haven't died in a flaming crash anywhere, but we've successfully landed on the moon. Now, they can't leave Professor Werner by himself, so what Bill does is gets Werner to agree to help him put the relay thing up there. Now, it doesn't occur to them to just tie the guy up really thoroughly and have Colonel Brighteyes help him, because girls can't do electronics. So Werner and Bill wander off to the into the lunar hills, and just by the sheerest coincidence, Dr. Werner falls down and smashes his helmet and dies. And Bill has only just enough oxygen to stagger back to the spaceship, go in the little lift chair, and get back aboard. Now, they don't have any fuel to launch again. They've got plenty of food and water and air. So they finally get in touch with Earth, and everybody's happy that they've landed on the moon. The general's happy, the president's happy, but the general has a talk to each of them separately and basically says, because it's 1970 and sexual mores haven't moved on since the 1930s, the only way we can have a man and a woman on the moon together in a spaceship, which is going to be the start of a moon base, is if they get married, because you can't have two single people cohabitating, even if it's on another planet. This is another Heinlein thing. He did it a number of times in books. He really did force people together in the most clumsy ways. The meet cute would immediately be followed by a marry cute in a lot of Heinlein's work. And it's a bit of lazy writing, if you ask me. But that's the way he did it. And it's very much apparent in this movie. So after a little bit of dithering and a little bit of secretly talking to each other, Colonel Brighteyes cuts a deal with the general, which will make her fiancé slash soon-to-be husband feel much better about his masculinity. She gets the general to make Bill a general, and therefore he's of a superior rank to her, and that makes it okay, according to alternative Robert Heinlein, 1970 sexual mores. It's okay for them to do that under that circumstance. So they get married via the big view screen, which is actually a big hole cut in the set with another set behind it, because that's how low the budget was. And then the President of the United States comes onto the screen, and surprise, surprise, we find out that it's an elderly lady. The end. But to be fair to this movie, they at least tried to educate the American population on space travel. They didn't try to educate them on sexual mores, didn't try to educate them on the role of women in the future or anything like that, or the fact that it's a bit suspicious that communists are more organized than the American military are. None of that stuff. It's all about space and about technology and about manifest destiny and about the military-industrial complex and all those other things that were part of 1950s life. And there was another thing that made me chuckle a little bit, and this is purely an historical thing. When at the start you see the communist spies, who totally drop off the plot after they plant the fake Professor Werner on the spaceship, they do it in San Francisco, and San Francisco that they have looks exactly like San Francisco in the early 1950s. And it occurred to me, thinking as I do laterally, that they would be shockers in the real 1970 San Francisco, because these guys are all wearing baggy 1940s suits and basically hats and all sorts of shit like that. And as soon as they walk out that door, they're going to be confronted by hippies, by Haight-Ashbury, by LSD, by the Doors, the Love and Spoonful, Moby Grape, the Electric Prunes, Big Brother and the Holding Company, women in macrame tops with no bras on, hot pants, guys with long hair, people reading weird books like Stranger in a Strange Land, and all the other stuff that we know of in the 1970 from our world. And that's the one thing that took me out of this movie this time I watched it, was the fact that their 1970 San Francisco was nothing like the San Francisco of Zabriskie Point and other movies like that. It really does show how much change was in America in that 17-year period, how things really were revolutionized and evolutionized and moved on. It's like somebody in 1923 made a movie about 1953, where people were still wearing spats and straw boaters. It just wouldn't play well. To widen this theme out, that's one of the problems with movies that posit being in the future. They do it badly. They do it really strangely. Now, we know much better how to do it now. If you take a movie like Her, which I've spoken about on a previous podcast, there's a million subtle details in that movie that say near future. There's the change in men's fashion, the fact that the protagonist has a job that doesn't exist now, the way people accept operating systems as people, all of this kind of stuff. There are all these different touches there that speak to a change in culture. But what this movie, Project Moonbase, does, doesn't talk about a change in culture. It makes a really big assumption that's kind of weird and really is one of the problems with Heinlein-style science fiction in a lot of ways. And that is, there's an assumption that as technology moves on, it's not going to impact society. It's not going to impact sexual morality. It's not going to impact the good versus evil simplicity of the Cold War era American view of communism, which of course a lot of Americans still have. All you got to do is look at Facebook to know that. And just to widen this out a little bit, the biggest problem with Project Moonbase, and this is not Project Moonbase's fault, is that it's the kind of science fiction that the sad and the rabid puppies would love. It's got rocket ships, it's got women in subservient places, it's got capitalists versus communists, it's got a strong military background, it's got moon bases and all that kind of thing. Whereas the science fiction that we know and love now is a lot more complex than that, and a lot deeper and a lot stranger. And I mean strange in an incredibly positive way as well. Strangeness is a thing of beauty. We keep finding out new things about the universe as well, which is really groovy. We found out only this year that life on Earth is 1 billion years older than we thought it was. Now, that's mind-blowing. That is really a mind-fuck of a thing. And that's got implications for the search for extraterrestrial life as well. We don't have to just search for planets that are roughly the same age as our own. You know that there may well be life on planets that are a lot younger than our planet. And that's kind of weird, fucked up, and groovy. We live in a world of incredible kind of duality. We've got people who deny that the world is more than 6,000 years old and yet use complex computers as communication devices all the time. We have a world where we know literally hundreds of planets in other solar systems, and yet we can't get anybody to walk on the moon again. We live in a world where we know incredible amounts about the origin of the species now and how human beings evolved and how similar all of our races are genetically. And we're having wars with a resurgence of a medieval culture and people who want to take us back there while using 21st century weapons to do it. We're in strange times and strange and interesting times and weird times and transitional times. And looking back at a movie this simple and this kind of retrograde, each year it gets more and more strange to us and more mystifying and more annoying as we kind of move towards unknown opportunities and unknown crises. We're warming the planet, but we're getting to the point right now where people are going to be able to generate their own power, and that's going to be a big change too. Elon Musk's household batteries are going to be wildly paradigm-changing for the world. We don't know where that's going to go, whether it's going to fall on its ass or whether it's going to revolutionize everywhere. It's going to have immense consequences to electricity grids, and power structures, political power structures as well. It's going to make certain things irrelevant. It's going to make oil less important to us. It's going to mean we can use renewables a lot better. Now, I'm 58 now. I'm not a young man anymore. I hope I'm not a senile one, but I'm not a young man anymore. But those changes excite me rather than terrify me. There are men my age, white men my age in particular, who fear that kind of change, who fear the fact that marriage isn't what it was when they were young, who fear that the world isn't going to respect them the way it had in the past and isn't going to give them the privileges that they had in the past, and that there are other people who are equally deserving of those privileges who are now standing up and demanding them. There are people feeling threatened by that, and people feeling lost by that, and people feeling scared about that. But I'm not. I don't see things that way. I mean, in a lot of ways, I'm a dinosaur. But I hope I'm a long-lived one. I want to be a long-lived dinosaur. That's my option. But I want to be one that at least tries to adapt to the 21st century in a way that too many people of my ilk aren't. I love the fact that we're learning to treat women better and to treat children better and to uncover the crimes of the past, particularly when it comes to child abuse and spousal abuse and other things like that. I've spoken about that on the radio and about my own experience of domestic abuse and how the world was so different when I was a child that stuff wasn't revealed until I spoke about it on the radio this very year. The future's not going to be technology. It's not necessarily going to be our rockets and space stations. That's going to be part of it, and I hope that part of it thrives as well. I really hope we do. I hope somebody does a gay marriage on the moon before I die. I want to live to see that. I want to also live to see about 40 or 50 more James Bond movies and the end of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Whether that happens or not, who gives a fuck? I'm going to try for that. But a movie like Project Moonbase tells me one thing, that there are people who, in one respect, were going for change. They wanted to go to the moon. They wanted to go to the stars. They wanted all of that stuff. What they didn't want was their society to change. And that's reflected in the script that Hyland wrote for Project Moonbase. He still thinks that the relationship between the Russians and America was going to be the same 17 years in the future. He assumed that people were going to dress the same. He assumed that men and women's relationships and their options were going to be the same. And even when he did throw in little bits of wow, like having a female president and having Yuri Gagarin being an American woman, he couldn't follow through on that to any meaningful extent. He couldn't have a female character in this movie worthy of respect. And that's one of the limitations we all have. I mean, and again, going back to the rabbit and the sad puppies, that's one of their essential problems with people of that ilk and the way that they're viewing things. They're scared of changes that are being made. They're scared of the way the world's changing, when they don't need to be, because all it's going to do is, it means that there are going to be more interesting things to read and more interesting people to talk to about them and more interesting viewpoints coming into the genre. And I like that. I don't read as deeply into science fiction as I should, and I'm going to try to get some cutting-edge science fiction books and speculative fiction books while I'm at Continuum in the next couple of weeks. But we really do need to embrace the change. We can guide it, and we can have our opinion on it, and we can vote for or against it, but we need to acknowledge it, and we need to respect the fact that there's change. I don't think any of us want to live in a Project Moonbase future where the technology advances, but everybody else stays the same. It's really one of the worst options. But there are people and movements around that seem to want us to be there. And that's a bit of a shame, because the future is going to be groovy, as Dennis Hopper once said in My Science Project. And I want us to embrace the grooviness. Anyway, I'm going to end it there. I had a much longer rant that I recorded. I went off into weird tangents, in fact, yesterday when I was recording the first part of this podcast. But I'm going to leave it there for Project Moonbase and go on to something that's ineffably and wonderfully silly and doesn't have any hidden politics at all that I can discern. And that is 1988's Killer Clowns from Outer Space, produced, directed, and done everything pretty much by the Chiodo brothers.
It was a night like any other night. Then something happened. You see that? Something different.
There's no shooting star.
Why here? Why now? Why clowns? They've been knocking them dead all over the universe.
What are you gonna do? Knock my block off?
Soon they'll be doing it at a theater near you.
Killer Clowns from Outer Space.
Maybe they're just cruising through the galaxy and stopped here for a bite to eat.
You don't need a police, pal. You need a psychiatrist.
They want to play games? They're messing with the wrong guy.
What are you in for?
Killer Clowns from Outer Space. It's crazy.
Some people blame Stephen King, and some people blame John Wayne Gacy, and some people have no idea why there is an epidemic of chlorophobia at the moment. And chlorophobia, for those who don't know that and can't get to Wikipedia right now, is a fear of clowns. Sally, my darling wife, says that she got it because of a smart-ass clown that she saw at the opening of a Toys R Us store. I'm not disbelieving it, I'm just putting it out there that that's what happened. And I remember when I first watched Circus Boy, when I was a very small child. Circus Boy was a TV series in the 1950s, starring Mickey Dolenz, who was using the name Mickey Braddock for no good reason at the time. And they had a clown at the start of that, and when I was like, well, I don't know, 3 or 4, it scared me. When I was 5 and I watched it, it didn't scare me anymore. I knew the clown was a good guy, played by Noah Beery, who went on to play Jim Rockford's father in The Rockford Files. So I was cool. I've been cool with clowns ever since then. It's really not an issue for me. I haven't got a problem with it. Krusty doesn't faze me. None of them do. But there's a lot of people out there who have a dread fear of clowns, which is a little bit silly. It's like being scared of unicorns. It's like being scared of Cthulhu toys. I haven't really asked, but do people also get scared of mimes? Is there a kind of flow over it to mimes? Who knows? If you're scared of clowns, drop me an email and let me know whether mimes make you break into a cold sweat. I just put something up on Facebook asking whether chlorophobes were scared of mimes as well. So I'll let you know if I get a result on that before I finish recording. I'm looking up a webpage about it. It's called chlorophobiafacts.com. And it says the phobia can cause a state of panic, difficulty in breathing, irregular heartbeats, sweating, nausea, and feelings of fear. I had the same thing with amphetamines and at the start of an acid trip. So that would make a good headline. Clowns, the new LSD. Or clowns, a new crystal meth. So anyway, people are scared of clowns, and the TV miniseries It, based on a novel by Stephen King and starring Tim Curry, is one of the reasons people give for this sudden resurgence in chlorophobia. But I don't have it, and so I'm going to talk about Killer Clowns from Outer Space. In fact, a friend of mine on Facebook, the lovely Kate, found out today that she has chlorophobia because she was in a university course and a clown appeared on the screen and she went, ah, shit, and got really scared about it. So it's a weird and strange thing, coulrophobia. But moving on, 1988, 2 years before it, we have a much more benign manifestation of dangerous clowns in the Chiodo Brothers movie, made for about $2 million, Killer Clowns from Outer Space. By the way, I have just checked Facebook, and Miss Jane, one of my Patreon supporters for the podcast, says, I asked a question, so all you coulrophobes out there, do you get shit scared of mimes too? And Miss Jane said, not my favourite, but no, only clowns. So we've got 100% verification that it's not mimes, it's only clowns. But anyway, on to Killer Clowns from Outer Space. As I've said before, the movie was made in 1988 by Stephen Charles and Edward Chiodo, who are the Marx Brothers of Killer Clown movies in my book. And it stars Grant Kramer, Suzanne Snyder, John Alan Nelson, and John Vernon, with Royal Dano in there as well. John Vernon, you might remember, played the guy who fucked Lee Marvin's wife in Point Blank and did not get away with it. He's a Canadian actor. He started his career in Canada. If you ever saw the 1960s Marvel superheroes cartoons, the ones where they basically mimeographed the comic books and animated them, John Vernon did the voice of a number of characters, including Prince Namor of Atlantis, just to link it all into the Marvel Cinematic Universe in some very obscure way. Now, I'm sure there's a way to link everything into the Marvel Cinematic Universe at this stage, or if not, there soon will be. So the story is pretty simple on this one. There's not a lot of complexity to it. In fact, IMDb has it down to one sentence. Aliens who look like clowns come from outer space and terrorize a small town. That's it. That's all you need to know to get things started. It's basically the same plot as The Blob, but we're substituting clowns for raspberry jam. Okay, so the movie is supposed to be funny and probably isn't quite as funny as it's supposed to be, because you've got some comic relief in here, which is not a bad thing at all. And, yeah, comic relief is an important part of a movie about clowns, of course. And you've got the comic relief, in this case, the Terenzi brothers, played by Michael Siegel and Peter Lucchese. And they basically run an ice cream van with a giant clown on the roof of it. See, there's a clown motif through the whole thing. It's not just the clowns from outer space itself. There's a clown motif in the town. There's a burger joint where everybody hangs around, kind of like Arnold's in Happy Days. Though in this case, it's a Big Top Burger, because clown motif again. So the Terenzi brothers decide that they're going to they hire an ice cream truck. They have a couple of ladies in the ice cream truck who they think will sleep with them because they give them ice creams. Doesn't work out like that. And they're the comic relief. You don't see them too much, and they're kind of a little bit underwritten as characters, but, you know, they're in there. So basically, as I said, it is The Blob. People see a meteorite crashing down outside town, and various people go to investigate it. First person we get to investigate it is the old codger. You've got to have an old codger in there investigating this stuff. In this case, it's character actor Royal Dano, whose face you'll recognize as soon as you see it. If you just Google Royal Dano after you listen to the podcast, of course. He started out doing a whole bunch of things. In fact, he was in a Hitchcock movie, The Trouble with Harry, in 1955. He was in The Seven Faces of Dr. Lowe. He did any number of films. I'm just looking through. He's in Johnny Guitar, Gunsmoke, let's see, Santiago, Moby Dick, the one John Huston did. He was in that as well. He was in a shit ton of westerns and TV series. And, yeah, basically, at The Outlaw Josie Whale, he was in that. He was in The Wild Party, which I talked about on a Paleo Cinema podcast, the first Merchant Ivory film. So this guy's got a track record. Now, it wasn't his last movie, Killer Clowns from Outer Space, but it's towards the end of quite an illustrious character acting career. He died in 1994, so he still had 6 years to live in this. And he does a pretty good job playing the old codger who, with his dog, goes out to investigate the thing that crashes out in the woods and finds out that it's a giant circus tent. And he and his dog, and of course there's always got to be a hound dog there, get killed by the clowns. There's no two ways about it. I'm not going to do spoilers in this, but they get killed by the clowns. And then, of course, the hero, who has a really strange name, and I'm not sure whether it was meant to be funny or whether it was just the way these guys thought. But the protagonist of this piece is a character called Mike Tobacco, played by Grant Kramer, who, with his girlfriend Debbie Stone, played by Susan Snyder, go out to investigate it, and things get weird, and they find out there's giant clowns in there, and they're trying to convince the cops in the town. Dave Hansen in particular. Dave was actually the name of the cop as well in The Blob, if you remember. So they deliberately, you know, using the template of The Blob for their particular movie, the Chiodo brothers are. And he's the kind of slightly sympathetic cop, whereas the old misanthropic one is played by John Vernon. His name's Mooney. And he doesn't believe anything, and he comes to a nasty end anyway, so it doesn't really matter. But it follows that path of The Blob where people are getting killed in the town, and at first nobody realizes it, and they're trying to convince the cops before more people get killed doesn't work, and then more people get killed and all shit breaks loose. Basic Blob template. Now, here's where it gets interesting, in the fact that the Chiodo brothers, who started out as model makers, they were model makers and puppeteers and special effects guys with their own special effects place, which is still going, which is nice. They're the guys who made the stop motion animation for Large Marge in Pee-wee's Big Adventure, just to give you some of the credibility that these guys have. And so they spent all of their money on the production, well, most of the money on the production. So $2 million budget, they spent it on the lights, they spent it on the actors, they spent it on the sets. They spent it on everything but the special effects, and had to do the special effects quite cheaply. But these guys are primo, really good special effects guys. And I watched this on Blu-ray. There's a shock video Blu-ray, an Australian one out at the moment. You'll pick it up in Australia for under $20. I think I may have got it for 14 or 15 or something ridiculously low like that. And so in high definition, the special effects still look good, which is great credit to, and these aren't computer effects. This is pre-computer effects. And the effects really look good. There's actually a wiki for Killer Clowns from Outer Space, which is a useful resource for podcasts like this. So if you go to Killer Clowns with K's, of course, .wikia.com, you've got the really cool wiki that's been put together for Killer Clowns from Outer Space, which is kind of cool and really useful. And all of the clowns have names as well, which I didn't know until I took a look at the wiki. And there's a gallery. It says gallery. See the gallery of Killer Clowns from Outer Space. But the clowns are very kind of nasty and monstrous looking clowns. And they look like somebody took babies and left them in a river for a fortnight. The clowns, and I'll give you the clowns' names just so we've got everything ready. There's Jumbo, Fatso, Shorty, Rudy, Spiky, Slim, Bibbo, Chubby, Joe, Magori, and Jojo the Clownzilla, which is a giant clown they meet at the end of the thing. And there are two female killer clowns who make out with the Terenzi brothers. But that's a spoiler, but I don't care. And there's a whole bunch of really nice pictures just showing the wonderfulness. Oh, yes, and there are also the clown offspring. But I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself here. The clowns have weapons related to clowns and circuses, which is kind of lovely. They've got cotton candy cocoon guns, which basically spin cotton candy cocoons around people so they can grab people. And the cocoons pre-digest them so that the clowns can drink the juices out of a human being with an enormous sippy straw. They've got popcorn bazookas, which are actually the clowns' ways of reproducing, and I'll leave the rest of that for you to see the movie. There are balloon ray guns, which encapsulate people in balloons, which then float away like they've just got helium in them. The laws of physics and killer clowns from outer space simply don't go together. They have a pie fight with acid pies. They have a clown package. They have a bubblegum pistol. They have a cotton candy bazooka as well. And yeah, so basically the inventiveness of this movie is fantastic. They go, okay, what do clowns have? Clowns have a clown car. Let's get a whole bunch of clowns to come out of a clown car. What do clowns do? Clowns do shadow puppets. How can we use that? And they use the essential creepiness of clowns and the fact that you don't know who they are underneath the makeup to great effect in this movie. I mean, it's pretty obvious when you look at the clowns up close that they're definitely not a person in a clown suit. If you're in the movie, I mean, yeah, we know that there are people in clown suits and there are all sorts of little bits to make the ears and the faces and the eyebrows move and all that kind of thing. But if you're in the world and you see something like that and it's got teeth on it like a leprous Doberman, you know that it's not just some guy in a costume. But the people in the town don't realize that. They see a clown, they automatically assume it's Noah Beery. But it isn't. It's these human-eating, nasty fuckers with six senses of humour and absolutely no moral compasses at all. But this is the kind of movie where you don't actually analyse the science of the killer clowns and things like that. You go along for the ride. It's not meant as a serious science fiction movie. It's a comedy horror film. And it's a lot of fun. But having said that, if you go to IMDb and look up Killer Clowns from Outer Space, there's something a little bit funny there. Go to the FAQ, and one of the users about 2 years ago said, why did the clowns put Debbie and the other women into giant balloons? Debbie and the other women are put into giant balloons to keep them fresh for later in order to eat some of them. It would also appear they are others trapped in giant balloons below on another floor so that the giant clown could eat some of them too. Other reasons are to impregnate the girls or to turn them into female clowns as well. But it's not fully known if this is truly the case or not. It's possible the clowns have more than one way to reproduce their race. It should at least be noted that there were two female clowns on board the spaceship. So somebody's actually taken this really stupid question about killer clowns from outer space and tried to give the person a reasonable answer to it. No credit to them for doing that. It's a bit silly to ask those kind of questions, this sort of movie. You go along for the ride. Now, I saw this originally on VHS back in the day. I think I might have been living in St. Kilda East at the time, and my good then girlfriend and I used to go down on a Saturday night, and you'd go to the local video store and pick up some movies to watch and just chill out. And, you know, watch some movies, eat some food, get laid, all the kind of things you do on a Saturday night when you're not going out. So that's where we picked up Killer Clowns from Outer Space and watched it. And having both had the same sixth sense of humour, which is another thing that attracts me to a woman. That's why Sal and I are together. We enjoyed the hell out of it too, even though it was VHS and we didn't know video quality. We didn't have HD and shit like that. We just put up with cathode ray tubes and VHS tapes. But Killer Clowns from Outer Space had a certain punk sensibility to it. It's got a theme song which is very kind of punk. It's got that late 1980s jaggedy script in the title sequence. And it's one of those movies that is specifically designed for that kind of crowd, for people watching it on VHS or watching it in a cheap cinema or even at that stage watching it in a drive-in because all of the drive-ins hadn't gone yet and just kind of going for the ride. It's in the same kind of league with things like Sorority Babes at the Slime Ball Bowl-O-Rama, which I have a DVD of as well. And those kind of things. Movies like The Jitters, which introduced to English-speaking cinema the idea of Guangxi, the Chinese hopping vampires, all of that kind of stuff. And if I can get up and stretch this headset microphone far enough, I can even give you some more examples because they're all up on the shelf here in the man cave. Let's see what other movies we could put into the same genre. And I'm about to trip over a flashlight, which I dropped on the floor. But that actually didn't work. I can't see them from here. But anyway, it's in that kind of thing. Yeah, you would have rented it along with things like maybe the Philadelphia Experiment or Sorority Babes at the Slime Ball Bowl-O-Rama or Hollywood Chainsaw Hookers or any one of those ones. This movie doesn't have any nudity in it, which is a little bit unusual for the time, but I suppose with clowns, they thought they might actually hit a kid demographic, so they didn't want to go the normal path of throwing tits in for tits' sake, even though that is something that a lot of people like. Yes, and I am vulgar enough to admit that there are times when I don't mind a bit of gratuitous nudity in a movie. It actually wakes you up during the slow bits. Now, the Chiara brothers went on to do other things as well. They were mostly known as puppeteers, and they were actually the main puppeteers. Charles Chiara was the main puppeteer on Team America World Police, for instance. And they did a number of other bits and pieces. They actually did Fairy Tale Theatre in 1986, Critters and Critters 2, Alien Abduction, Screamers. They did the mechanical Screamers in the movie I've already talked about on the podcast, I think, Screamers, with Peter Weller in it, based on yet another Philip K. Dick story. And they even did some puppeteer work in some live-action bits and pieces that were attached to the Simpsons TV series. So the Chiara brothers have definitely got a reputation in the industry as being able to produce the quality. And this movie shows it too. The makeup and the design of the clowns is particularly good. Each one's got its own personality. They're all different heights and different shapes and sizes. But they do portray personality personality in a number of ways, which is kind of good. And the actors they get to wear the costumes do seem to be able to project through the makeup and through the all of the cables and other things they use to manipulate the clowns in an interesting way. And the designs themselves, of course, help to portray the characters, the clowns. The clown spaceship is very cool as well. It's you can see it's done on a fairly low budget, but it is beautifully designed and logical. And there are even a couple of moments of wow in there, where they enter a part of the spaceship and there's a giant plasma ball in there, which brings to mind things like the Klystron relays in Forbidden Planet. There's a lot of those little homages to earlier films. So these guys definitely know this stuff and definitely know the genre cinema and do a particularly good job of letting you in on the joke, for instance. And John Vernon, of course, has to play the straight guy. He's the guy who doesn't believe any of this is happening. He's the cop who everybody hates because he's an asshole. And he plays that very well. But there's one scene right at the end, where just before the end of his part of the movie, which is genuinely disturbing. They throw in one thing to do with Officer Mooney and the clowns, which is really off-putting in a great way. And it does show that they really did have the ability to make a horror movie, a straight horror movie, had they chosen to do so. But of course, that wasn't where their heart was. They wanted to make an entertainment. They wanted to make a funny movie. They wanted to put fucking killer clowns in outer space. And they've done that. But that one scene with Officer Mooney is really impressive. Now, the leads aren't that impressive. They're reasonable actors. Nobody does a shit job of it, really. But they're undistinguished in the script and the plot and perhaps their talents don't really give them much to work with in this one. But having said that, they perform the function that they're supposed to. But our focus is always inevitably on the clowns and what they're going to do next. And in a sense, all of the human actors, with the possible exception of Royal Dano, are the straight men to the clowns. But there are some incredibly imaginative sequences. The sequence with the pie fight is pretty good. The sequence with the shadow puppetry is very well done and really nicely animated, and you wonder what they're going to do, what the clown's going to do next, and then it does it, and bam, they absolutely nail it. And the popcorn gun's very good, and the upshot of the popcorn gun is really good as well. This movie, it's one of those movies where, yes, it's a silly entertainment, and of course this is the silly episode of the podcast. It's a silly entertainment. It was never meant to be taken seriously, but it was done with real art and real heart by the Chiara brothers. And that's the reason why I like it, and that's the reason why I'm glad that Shock Video have released a reasonably priced Blu-ray copy of it, because it's a nostalgia kick for me, of course. But It's one of those movies that you can drag out. Even if there are kids around you, you've got a bunch of people over, you want to sit down and watch a movie. This isn't a bad one to do. Yes, you've got to be careful with the coulrophobes, but assuming that you've got people that aren't scared of clowns, this is a good movie to sit back with a bunch of people and watch with. Probably popcorn would be good, and big sippy straws in the drinks and all that kind of thing. You can do a whole clown theme on this and watch the movie and have a great time doing that. And that's basically why it was made. It was made to be an entertainment. It was made to be a lot of fun, and it definitely fulfills those. It gets about a 6.7 on IMDb, but to be honest with you, I like it a lot more than that. I like movies that portray things imaginatively and use the imagination of the creators, even when the budget's not fantastic, and they show you things you haven't seen before. And there's definitely stuff in Killer Clowns from Outer Space that you haven't seen before in a movie, you probably haven't seen since. And that's a good thing. You're getting your money's worth if a movie gives you a couple of wow moments and you just sit back with a smile on your face, just enjoying the creativity and the way that these guys created the concept and then just keep running with it and keep making it endlessly inventive and endlessly enjoyable. And this movie does that. It's not Citizen Kane. It's not even Blazing Saddles, but it's a good, honest piece of exploitation genre cinema. And I'm sure that anybody who saw it as a young kid, perhaps, or as a teenager back in the late 1980s has a great fondness for it as well. It really is. Watching it again made me all nostalgic for that time, in fact. But Killer Clowns from Outer Space is not for everybody, but if it's for you, you're going to enjoy it. So I'm going to wrap things up there. Now, I've got the end credits, of course, that the Patreon supporters get. And I did get a message from our friend Tim Leiby, who says that he did tell me what his credit wanted to be. Now, I haven't had time to record it onto there, but he's our New York location manager. So when you hear Tim's name at the end, Tim is the New York location manager. But anyway, I'm going to wrap this up now because it's a day late already and I probably should move things along. But I'd just like to thank you for listening and I'd like to encourage you to do so again. I'll be back in 2 weeks with another one of these, and the one after that's going to be the one that I record live on stage at Continuum 11, which is going to be a lot of fun. And Grant and Sonia are very, very canny movie buffs. I've had them on the podcast very early on, in fact, and I'd like to do so again. But this was a chance to get us all in one place at one time. The convention was kind enough to cut us a two-hour slot out from the program, and we're going to enjoy the hell out of talking about the Avengers Age of Ultron, and probably ripping chunks out of it in some ways as well. But in the meantime, all of you, look after yourselves, enjoy yourselves, keep safe, keep warm, and keep watching the skies, and I'll be back in 2 weeks. And here are the podcast credits in the style of movie credits. And the way to get on the credits is to donate to the podcast via patreon.com/paleocinema. Okay, we have Tim the mystery credit. I haven't got the credit from Tim yet. We have Tammy, the donut wrangler, Paul, the special makeup effects director, Mark, the second unit director, Alyssa, the location scout, Tansy, the Foley artist, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Christopher, the gaffer, Chris, the camera operator, and we'll wait for the big crescendo in the music, which is Alvarado del Gracioso by Ravel. Julia, the casting director, Elaine, the scientific advisor, Matt, the rattlesnake wrangler, Armin, the key grip, Jan, the dialect coach, Morris, the music director, Gary, the prop master, Claire, the script doctor, Grant, the technicolor consultant, Ian, the caterer, Sarah, the special effects technician, and Tom, the focus puller. Thank you very much to all of the people who support the podcast via the Patreon campaign. I'll catch you guys later.